2012, March 7th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 42, The Fermi Paradox. Well, yesterday, we looked at the question of interstellar travel and interstellar colonization. We saw two things. Number one is that space travel takes a really long time and takes a tremendous amount of energy, even if you are able to achieve relativistic star flight. As speeds of your spacecraft close to the speed of light or some significant fraction of the speed of light, if you can manage the energy expenditures, which are enormous, you still have a really long time between stars, you know, 50, 60 years between stars. But you can change the balance of things if you can actually colonize, and you have lots of time. And we saw that, in fact, reasonably modest star flight capability and a lot of time, a few tens or hundreds of millions of years, and you could, in principle, colonize the entire galaxy. And that leads us to this problem, which is now known as the Fermi paradox. Yesterday we left the lecture at the end. If colonization can occur so rapidly, in fact it can occur much more rapidly than geological timescales, 100 million years, where is everybody? Why haven't we actually run into an extraterrestrial intelligence at this point? It should be filling the galaxy multiple times over in the last 13 billion years of its life. Enrico Fermi in the 1950s stated this problem exactly that way, and it's now known as the Fermi paradox. So what we're going to be talking about today is this Fermi paradox and possible resolutions of it. The Fermi paradox is an apparent contradiction between estimates of the speed of colonization of our galaxy and the still apparent lack of any evidence for the extraterrestrials who might be doing that colonization. That's the where is everybody question. With paradoxes are basically they're logical problems. There are things that should be true, but you can't understand why they're not. So the proposed solutions, ways of resolving this paradox, are in fact that we have in fact come into contact with extraterrestrials. This is called the UFOs are real hypothesis. The possibility that civilizations in fact are out there, but they choose not to be noticed. And these come under various guises, the so-called zoo hypothesis, or perhaps it's an ethical decision, which is often referred to nowadays with the Star Trek-ism, a prime directive hypothesis. The other possibility is that civilizations are by their nature self-destructive. This is basically taking a leaf from the Drake equation and saying that civilizations are short-lived, they don't last long enough to be able to accomplish colonization, a process that takes millions of years. This is often referred to as the doomsday hypothesis for resolution. And finally, there is another hypothesis that says that the reason why nobody seems to be out there, why the Fermi paradox is resolved, is because life is in fact extremely rare, that even the Drake equation is overly optimistic, and is something that is now referred to as the rare Earth hypothesis. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on the rare Earth hypothesis because my opinion is, in fact, it is deeply flawed. But we'll take a look at what the basic statement of that is towards the end of the lecture. Going into that in detail is just far further afield than I want to go into in this class. So here's the statement of the problem. This is a picture we saw last lecture. What we saw is that interstellar colonization, once you get going, even with a fairly simple scheme of just simply every colony sends out two ships and each of those send out two ships, even if you couple that with relatively slow pace so that you hang out for about 500 or maybe a millennium before you send out the colonization fleet. And the second is that you have even a fairly modest starflight capability. So we aren't going to go for the super relativistic, antimatter-powered starships. We're going to go with relatively modest means of traveling the universe. What we're going to find is that very quickly is an exponential or geometric growth process. We start out with two. After four steps, we end up with a very large number. After 10 steps, we have 1,000 colonies. So the time to colonize an entire galaxy of 100 billion stars, depending upon your star flight capability and the degree of loss that you get, failed colonies, ranges between 10 and 100 million years. Even if you slow it down to where you're not even relativistic, you're still way sub-light, a percent the speed of light, and you wait for 500 years, or you wait up to 5,000 years before dispatching the next ship. So you have 500-year journeys and a 5,000-year wait before the dispatch of your next colony ships. You still have the inhabited zone of the galaxy would begin to expand at 0.1% the speed of light. That's sufficient to fill our entire galaxy up in 100 million years or less. Now again, these are relatively optimistic numbers, but everything you do only drops you down incrementally from that. So this leads us to a problem. It means that 100 million years is a really short time. The galaxy has been around for at least 13 billion years, and you can make certain reasonable estimates that maybe the star forming, you know, add a couple billion years for life to get started on the first generation of stars. On our planet, that was 3 or 4 billion years to get up to intelligence. Maybe it's 300 billion years. In 10 billion years, there's 100 million year intervals in that time. So the galaxy could have been colonized over and over again if this basic scenario is correct. Now, colonization time, again, it's small compared to the age of the galaxy for reasonable assumptions. The reason for this is because population dynamics in a colonization situation like I've described are exponential in their growth. This stands in very stark contrast to the assumptions of the Drake equation. The Drake equation is asking, how many advanced civilizations, technologically communicable civilizations, are there in the galaxy right now? But it makes no assumption about the spread of those civilizations beyond their home world. It simply makes a statement of how many stars are being born, how many of those stars have planets. Among those stars with planets, how many of those have Earth-like planets? Of those that have Earth-like planets, how many can harbor life? Of those that could harbor life, how many do have life? And of those that do have life, how many developed intelligent life? That's a static assumption. Once you allow population dynamics to come in, even with a relatively pessimistic version of the Drake equation behind you, you find out that the Drake equation should be, with population dynamics, a dramatic underestimate of the number of intelligent civilizations. So this left us exactly the same slide as where we left ourselves yesterday. Where is everybody? That was the question I left hanging in the air. Well, one of the people who asked that question of themselves, in fact, gave in many ways the most definitive formulation of the problem, was the physicist Enrico Fermi. Fermi is an Italian physicist. He originally did his work on nuclear physics, made fundamental discoveries, for example, discovering the neutrino. He was among those people who worked on the study of subatomic particles. In the 1930s, he won the Nobel Prize in Physics. He was working in Rome at the time. He fled Mussolini's fascist Italy for the United States, where he became a citizen of the United States, began working in nuclear physics. In 1942, during the height of the Second World War, he and his team at the University of Chicago were able to make the first nuclear reactor in human history, produced a sustained nuclear fission reaction that occurred, is now actually the prototype of all both nuclear fission reactions used for power plants, and demonstrated that fission chain reactions could occur, which laid the foundations of the Manhattan Project, which led to the development of the atomic bomb, which gave, through both Manhattan Project and especially Los Alamos, where Fermi himself went to work during the Second World War, led to the development of nuclear weapons and the end of the Second World War. Fermi went on to finish his career as a professor at the University of Chicago. He very tragically died of cancer at the age of only 53 years old. My contact with Fermi is actually that my PhD advisor was a student of Fermi's at Chicago in the post-war period. So there's kind of that sort of, you know, he's kind of in many ways kind of an intellectual grandfather of mine. The Fermi paradox came out of a 1950 lunchtime conversation at Los Alamos. Los Alamos was a very tightly knit community in the period immediately following World War II. These were some of the best minds in the world, or certainly in the not fascist world, that were able to escape to the United States away from Nazi Germany and Italy. They came and were put immediately onto the problem of trying to have the United States build the first atomic bomb to give them an edge in ending the Second World War, which had already at that point killed about 50 million people. The result was an extremely close-knit community as part of the Manhattan Project, and they would often have a tremendously high level of interaction. And what started the conversation in 1950 was this New Yorker magazine cartoon by Alan Dunn, which shows a flying saucer. This was a relatively new idea. People had claimed to see a flying saucer-shaped thing in the sky in the late 1940s. It was the first kind of crazy claims of that came out. And the cartoon shows a flying saucer landing on some alien world, depositing a group of aliens who are, and it's really kind of hard to read here, it says DSNY, which is the Department of Sanitation of New York. This was a joke about the fact that New York had a let's clean up New York and get rid of the litter campaign in the 1950s, and people went out and stole the trash cans. So the question is, who's stealing all the trash cans? And Alan Dunn's cartoon is, well, they're being taken by aliens in these newfangled flying saucers. So this cartoon was discussed at lunch, according to the anecdotes later told by Fermi and his colleagues. And Fermi, thinking through this, talking about this funny cartoon, got people talking about extraterrestrial life, and Fermi actually was one of the masters at doing the kind of order of magnitude sort of calculational quantitative reasoning that we really, one of the things that was really admirable about him. And he did the calculation in his head of the pace of colonization and said, hey, if that's the case, and we think the galaxy is, and at that time they thought it was maybe a few billion years old. They didn't have a good idea of the age of the galaxy at that, 1950. Said, where is everybody? There should be abundant, intelligent life throughout the galaxy because colonization is an exponential process. Furthermore, if that's the case, then the Earth should have been visited multiple times. These flying saucers should have been seen not simply in the period after World War II, which is the first real appearance of such things in the popular culture, but should have been throughout human history. But in fact, as far as anyone knows, and knows to this day, there is absolutely no evidence of extraterrestrial visitation of our planet. Nor have we come across any truly alien artifacts on our planet, things that clearly do not belong on this world. Every piece of metal that we find, some funny burned up twisted piece of metal some yokel finds out there in a burned field, turns out to be part of a, I don't know, 57 Chevy or something like that. The isotope ratios, the alloys are all unknowable and identifiable. Nothing of a truly alien or extraterrestrial origin has ever been identified on this planet that isn't something like a meteor, meaning an actual artifact, something made by an intelligence. And even that was true in 1950, and so the question was, where is everybody? Now, often the Fermi paradox is misstated. People talk about the Fermi paradox as really being a statement about the frequency of intelligent civilizations, meaning it's a variation on the theme that Frank Drake picked up in the 1970s with the Drake equation. That's incorrect. The Fermi paradox says nothing about the frequency of appearance of intelligences in the galaxy. It's a statement about the rapidity, the exponential rapidity of colonization. You don't have to have a high frequency or a low frequency of the emergence of intelligent life. You simply have to have that intelligent life want to colonize the galaxy. Once you do that, even a relatively modest capability can colonize the galaxy 100 or 1,000 times over within the 10 billion year lifetime of our galaxy. But in order for there to be at least one visitation of this planet, meaning they come within the sphere of influence of where we live now, it doesn't have to happen 50 or 100 times, it just has to happen once or twice. So we've got a vast overcapacity for this rate of colonization. But you don't need colonization 100 or 1,000 times since the birth of the galaxy. You just need it to happen once to have an overlap with the Earth. So here's the way it works out. Let's pull the Drake equation into this because it's our quantitative way of getting at this. If life and intelligence are very, very rare, so I put the numbers into the Drake equation where I say that instantaneously there is only one intelligent civilization now. And that's not too much of an extrapolation. In fact, I'm playing some unfavorable games with the frequency of how often life emerges and how often it becomes intelligent, with how long, but giving a huge advantage, even in this estimation, to how long those civilizations live. So I let them live long enough that they could colonize at least once, so about 100 million years. I'll make it 5 billion years and hedge the bets. We average this over the age of the galaxy, and I have at least two civilizations that should have done the colonization trick within that period. So even a highly pessimistic variation on the Drake equation, when coupled with exponential population dynamics, leads to at least two. At least one or two is needed to have at least come across our space. If, on the other hand, we go to the other extreme, we look at a very optimistic variation on this, and this is the shameless optimism version of the Drake equation that we used the other day, that predicted at any given time there are 50 civilizations and they're relatively short-lived. Even if we hedge our bets and say, well, maybe at least one or two of them would survive, that would lead to the possibility of 5 billion civilizations across our galaxy. So with a fairly modest change in the assumptions of the instantaneous number of intelligent civilizations in our galaxy now, when I couple that with exponential population dynamics, I can have between two civilizations to the present day or 5 billion. Now, there's lots of reasons why this is an extreme upper limit, but that's a huge range. And all you have to have is a range somewhere in between, and you're sitting there faced with a Fermi paradox. The numbers are relentless. Even for very modest assumptions about the frequency of intelligent life arising in the galaxy at any given instant, about having a very modest starflight capability and having even a fairly slow, leisurely colonization pace, you can fill the galaxy very, very rapidly. And yet there is no evidence of the presence of extraterrestrial civilizations that we've found to this point, nor ancient artifacts or so forth. And so the problem is, how do we resolve the Fermi paradox? Well, there's a number of solutions that have been proposed for how we resolve the Fermi paradox. And each of these is somewhat instructive in their own right. The first of these is to propose that we are, in fact, alone, that the Fermi paradox is there because life is even rarer than the most pessimistic assumptions. There are three possible resolute reasons for this fact that we're alone. One is that we've always been alone, that life, intelligent life, in places like the Earth are extremely rare. And this now goes by the name of the rare Earth hypothesis. The other possibility is that that lifetime of a civilization, is short, and it's always short. The civilizations just simply are suicidal. They eventually reach a point where they blow themselves up because their technological means outstrip their ethical means to deal with the possession of instrumentalities of access to energies that can destroy their own civilizations. So that's referred to as the doomsday hypothesis. Not surprisingly, that was a fairly popular hypothesis in the 50s and 60s when the threat of full-scale nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union was a very real everyday thing. I was born in 1961. I grew up through the 1970s and 80s. I can tell you that fear of nuclear war was very real when I was growing up. I grew up in a Navy base. We did duck and cover drills in grade school. Now, duck and cover drills were where you jump under your desk to avoid the immediate flash of a nuclear bomb blowing up over our base. This was a very real fear that people possessed. The other thing we get is that the other possibility that life is rare is not because you blow yourself up or because it's rare, but because nature is basically unkind. We've seen throughout the history of the Earth massive extinction events, right? The dinosaurs do not live on Earth because they were wiped out 65 million years ago by an asteroid impact. There might be an asteroid out there with our name on it, for all we know right now. Actually, we're starting to look for that because that possibility is real. NASA's spending millions of dollars a year surveying near space, looking for asteroids that might have humanity's name on it, and then thinking about how we might deal with that. Luckily, things in space move relatively slow. Space is big and empty, has an advantage. It might give us time to react. So the possibility is often referred to as the inhospitable universe hypothesis. The other possibility is that civilizations have arisen, that they're numerous, but they don't bother to colonize the galaxy. The first of these is because it's just plain difficult. As we've seen, it takes enormous expenditures of energy and time. And it may be that intelligent civilizations, after a while, decide that there's no gain in populating the galaxy, and they just don't spread out as much. So the exponential growth is basically curtailed by economic reality. The other possibility is because they just don't want to. It doesn't occur to them to go out and colonize. We'll say something about that in a moment. The other resolution that's been proposed is civilizations have, in fact, colonized the galaxy, but we don't know about it yet, either because we haven't found their signals yet, because we just aren't looking in the right way, because we can't tell, or maybe they're consciously avoiding us. They're not telling us, and that's what's referred to as the zoo hypothesis. They're protecting us from themselves or from contact with themselves. We'll say a bit about that in a second. And the other more extreme version of this says that we, in fact, they have colonized the galaxy, and we do have existence of this, but the government's lying to us about it. So let's deal with that one first, because I just want to get it out of the way and dispense with it. This is what we call the UFOs are real hypothesis. Here's another New Yorker cartoon from 1953 that I could not resist. It shows two aliens, the usual alien cartoon where they've got antennae, probably little green men, coming out of their flying saucer, and they're talking to a horse in the field, and they say, "Kindly take us to your president." This, by the way, is the origin of the common expression, "take me to your leader." This is the very first appearance in the popular culture of that phrase. And this is an idea that's gotten a long ways, that there have been extraterrestrial visitations, that they have, in fact, arrived. We have fuzzy photographs and anecdotal accounts of visits and abductions where they do bad things to Leroy, but we don't have any of those that actually constitute proof. There's no proof at all of any extraterrestrial visitation that anyone's ever presented. There's something referred to as the Sagan dictum. It's named for Carl Sagan. And it's the saying that extraordinary claims require extraordinary proofs. I used to put that on this slide and other slides like this when I gave this talk, but I no longer... A couple years ago, I podcast our lectures, actually out on iTunes, and one of my listeners called me on it. And he was right when I thought about it. It's actually, in many ways, it's an unnecessary moving of the goalposts. We don't have to say that extraordinary claims, like the appearance of UFOs, require extraordinary proof. All we have to do is say that claims require evidence. There are lots of claims, but there is zero repeatable, reliable evidence. You know, fuzzy photographs, anecdotes of Leroy getting picked up in the forest by creatures that did something to him. Come on. Claims of secret government conspiracies. If you've been paying at all attention to politics, do you think these guys can keep a secret and keep it for 50 years? No. Probably, highly unlikely. Someone would leak it out and the evidence would exist. Those evidences have been put forward as such patent fakes, it isn't even worth talking about. In fact, most of these governments can't even balance their own budgets, for God's sake, much less keep a secret of this magnitude. Now, this is not to say that there are not unexplained sightings, that there are not unexplained phenomena that people have seen, but just because you can't explain it now doesn't mean you have to leap to the most wild explanation for that. Every potential alien artifact that has ever been brought forward where someone has actually said, oh, well, I lost it. Oh, well, you know, I had that nifty alien. Oh, I lost it. I'm so sorry. When you've actually gotten it, it has, in fact, turned out to be a bent-up piece of a Ford Chevy. Crop circles. The best crop circles were in England for a long time. They found out it was actually a group of guys who hung out at the pub who called themselves the Masters of the Serial Universe. They had worked out a way to bother the farmers by going out and making crop circles. They'd have a few pints, make a couple crop circles, and then go back to the pub before closing time to have a couple more pints and laugh at their jokes. So every single case which has been given even the slightest scrutiny, doesn't even need extraordinary scrutiny, has come up severely wanting. So extraordinary claims do not require extraordinary proof. They simply require proof, and none has been forthcoming. And that's the last we're going to say about UFOs. Let's go on to more interesting possibilities. Let's work our way backwards through the list since we've started that way. The civilizations have, in fact, colonized the galaxy, but they're not telling us. This is often referred to as the zoo hypothesis. Variations on this theme have been called the Sentinel Hypothesis, based on an Arthur C. Clarke novel called The Sentinel, or a Prime Directive. It's an ethical decision on the part of the civilizations. Now, of course, the Prime Directive comes to us from Star Trek. This is my obligatory Star Trek reference. I think I've now fulfilled my quota for the quarter. The basis idea of the Zoo Hypothesis is that we human beings are too primitive to tell that we've actually been visited because either the visitors are too advanced or they're so different from us we have even no idea of even how to frame the question. Now, there's lots of examples of this from human history that inform that a thoughtful and ethical alien civilization of extremely advanced technology might avoid contacting even mildly technologically advanced civilizations like our own. For example, think about all the terrible things that happened just among our own species when technologically advanced Europeans showed up on the scene with European diseases and European weapons. Things did not work out so well for the native inhabitants of our continent, for the Polynesian islanders. All of those populations and civilizations collapsed. Take, for example, the Taino people. They vanished within a generation of Columbus appearing due to a combination of European diseases, principally smallpox, and mistreatment at the hands of the conquistadors. They simply became extinct. Handfuls of Taino words work their way through our language. Okay, if you've ever slept in a hammock or had a barbecue, those words are from the Taino language, even though the Tainos have been extinct for 500 years. These have been referred to as fatal impacts. Any advanced civilization that has come in contact with the less advanced civilization, even on our own planet, and we're the same species, for heaven's sake, this has always gone badly for the less advanced civilization. Now imagine a civilization that's capable of starflight. They might be so far advanced above us that it makes the first contact between Europeans and Taino look like two people meeting and having a handshake out in the middle of the oval. so they might realize the danger of letting themselves know that there's someone not only superior to them, but vastly superior in terms of technology, could in fact severely damage the civilizations. All these civilizations we've come in contact have been affected. They borrow language, they borrow words, sometimes they even ineffectively borrow technologies. What if they have instrumentalities that are way past our ability to control? They wouldn't want to get it in our hands. That is what the zoo or so-called sentinel hypothesis. They're protecting themselves, protecting us from the effects of the impacts. There's a lot of downsides to that explanation. It kind of makes the advanced civilization seem kind of snooty and patronizing. We're sufficiently curious, we are willing to take the risk to meet them. So it's not clear to me that this is such a great explanation, but you would notice that an alien civilization probably could go out of its way to hide its presence. We know, for example, that radio communication, which is the primary way we look for intelligences, you might begin to shut down that communication through closed channels just because it's much more energy efficient to do so. We're seeing that happen on our own planet, right? The radio noise of the Earth is slowly getting quieter and quieter because it's much more energy efficient for us to use closed channels and fiber optics. So advanced civilizations may go dark, and if they go into starflight, might carry that technology with them. They might have ways of communicating that are way beyond electromagnetic radiation. We don't possess that, we wouldn't be able to eavesdrop. So there's lots of reasons why this particular system couldn't work. Now, the other possibility that people have done as a variation on this theme is that the civilizations, I've sort of led into this, the civilizations have in fact populated the galaxy, but we just haven't noticed yet. Now, one of those hypotheses says, in fact, that aliens are in fact living among us. They are covertly monitoring our culture and watching and reporting back to the mothership. This is Mrs. Chippy. This is the other cat. I promised that she would get shown to the class, too. Sometimes I wonder that maybe at night when she's meowing that she isn't reporting back on us to the mothership. But that aside, the other possibility is that aliens use a form of communication that we haven't developed yet. We cannot eavesdrop using radio and microwave technologies. So they may be out there, but we're looking in the wrong place. We're looking in the wrong way because they're using technologically more advanced means. Don't ask me what they are. Maybe they're transmitting tight neutrino beams to each other or something else like that, and we just have no way of eavesdropping on that technology. They're using a highly energy efficient, highly directed form of communication. After all, if we communicated primarily with lasers, even side splash from lasers would come out as electromagnetic radiation. If we communicated with tight beams of neutrinos, subatomic particles that are nearly but not quite massless, well, in principle, it'd be very difficult to get side splash off of that. It'd be very efficient. Now, the other thing that's possible is that civilizations have not colonized the galaxy. Part of this, one of the reasons, is because, as we've already seen, it requires enormous expenditures of energy. For a civilization to actually muster the resources to colonize a galaxy, they would need to be able to manipulate the energy of entire stars in equivalence. Now, there's a guy, even though I would not put it up here, I'll just say as a quick aside, there's a Russian by the name of Kardashev who came up with a threefold classification of civilizations. A Kardashev type 1 civilization could utilize and manipulate the energy resources of an entire planet. Not just simply utilize energy, but you could manipulate and control volcanoes, earthquakes, and weather. A Kardashev type 2 civilization controls the full energy of an entire star, can manipulate stars as sources of energy, and a Kardashev type 3 civilization does that same thing of utilizing the energy and manipulation of an entire galaxy. By the Kardashev scale, we are a Kardashev level 0 civilization. We have access to atomic energy, but we can't control the weather, we can't control earthquakes, or we can't really utilize the full energy potential of our planet. So imagine that you have, you know, to do starflight, you actually do the budgeting for modest starflight, meaning we going out and colonizing just the local solar neighborhood would require us to become a Kardashev level 1 civilization. We would have to muster the energy resources of our entire planet or planets within our solar system to then multiply that out billionfold to get out to the scale of the Milky Way galaxy requires at least a Kardashev level 2 civilization. We would need to literally tap the energy of entire stars to do this. So such expense may be just too big to bear, may be too difficult. So one possible way is you don't go in person, but you use autonomous robotic probes instead of using these expensive big starships. Once you want to ship people, even if you ship people only in the form of genetic instructions for constructing them on the end, it still takes an awful lot of energy to pull that off. There's a couple different variations upon this theme that have been computed. Johnny von Neumann, the famous mathematician who was one of the fathers of modern computing, who also worked in the Manhattan Project, came up with the idea of self-replicating machines, that the machines would carry instructions for making copies of themselves. They'd land on an asteroid, mine the asteroid, make the raw materials, and go. You carry the instructions, right? Instructions are cheap compared to the entire organism. That's why DNA spreads so fast. DNA is just instructions. It gathers the resources, the components from the environment to build the organism. So he abstracted that to a machine, and so you would have intelligent machines. For example, for those of you fans of science fiction, Rendezvous with Rama is an example of one of these type of von Neumann type autonomous machines. In fact, Rendezvous with Rama was actually an example of the second type, a so-called Bracewell probe. A Bracewell probe is shown, and this is the best picture I could find of one. It's a giant SETI machine. It travels between stars. It's very lightweight. It's basically a radio receiver and transmitter. When it finds intelligent signals in local space, it phones home. And that's what a Bracewell machine does. It simply travels between the stars, perhaps is usually implemented as a form of a von Neumann machine that builds a copy to itself. So the von Neumann machine finds a place, builds a copy, builds a couple copies, and sends them out in various directions. Both of these work in the direction of giving you the exponential colonization growth, but it does so at lower cost because the machines themselves are low mass and have relatively lower energy requirements to work. But you don't have to have life support or anything to cause people to go run around. And if a von Neumann machine or a Bracewell probe takes 1,000 years to go between stars, you don't care because there's no one living on board. It just simply has to be well built. So that's what's often referred to as the it's too expensive problem. And this is in principle possible. Maybe one of these days a Bracewell type probe or a von Neumann machine might actually pass through our system. So far we have seen none. Von Neumann, by the way, was probably not directly involved in the conversation with Fermi on that afternoon, but he certainly knew and was a good friend of Fermi, and the von Neumann machines came up after the original statement of the Fermi paradox. The other possibility is that civilizations do, in fact, have the ability to colonize the galaxy. They just don't want to spend the effort. The reason why this is not very satisfying is there is no precedent for this in our own history. Again, we have no basis of comparison with other civilizations save our own, but every single civilization that we know of on our planet has eventually wanted to spread out and colonize. Their means may have been different. You know, Maori double canoes is one way. Giant ships of the East India Company are another. But the same basic thing is there. Once you get curious about what's over on the other side of the hill, someone's going to go. It basically seems to be absolutely counter to our human nature to not care what's over the next ridge, what's beyond the next horizon. So it almost seems like if you can make it that far, that you're just going to decide, we're going to turn into a planet full of Zen monks and go away. That just seems highly unlikely. It might happen, but it seems highly unlikely to me. That's an opinion, not a statement of fact. The other possibility is that civilizations have not gone out and populated the galaxy because civilizations are fragile, because they self-destruct before they can actually muster the ability to actually go out and colonize a galaxy. Again, we can draw from human history's experience that human populations tend to grow much faster than sustainability, the old Malthusian argument. Basically, we human beings have a history which shows a tendency towards aggression. We do tend to pick fights pretty easily. We don't seem to be very good at long-range planning, witness massive budget deficits and so forth, things like that. Oh, yeah, the grandkids will pay for that. And we have been notably irresponsible with technology. It isn't long after any technological advance has almost immediately been turned into something to hit one's neighbor with. This probably comes from the first ability to pick up a bone and smack someone, see the opening scenes of 2001, and you get the idea. So this is often referred to as the rather gloomy answer to the Fermi paradox, the so-called doomsday hypothesis. That once you develop the ability to manipulate the atom, because uncontrolled nuclear reactions are much easier than controlled reactions, you end up blowing yourself up in a nuclear war. We came awfully close at various times in our history. Read about nowadays when the Soviet Union's collapsed and we have access to the secret Soviet archives, read about what actually happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's really frightening. Biological warfare. This is one of the reasons why biological warfare is banned by international treaty. It scares the hell out of us that you can make a superbug and not control it. We have a bad enough time containing the flu, much less a flu bug that's engineered to be 100% deadly. That just scares the hell out of everybody. But if something like that gets loose, game over. Accidental contamination. A nuclear accident like Three Mile Island or Fukushima could be far worse if it gets into the worst places. Nanotechnology catastrophes. This is one of the favorite ones of some recent science fiction authors. You build micro machines that basically reduce the world to gray goo, because they basically are micro von Neumann machines that go around getting all of the raw materials, and basically everything is a raw material to a runaway machine. See, for example, the remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still. That's an example of nanotechnology catastrophe used as a form of weaponry. Environmental catastrophes. This is the thing that's behind some of the more extreme worries about global warming, that could we actually push it to the point of a runaway greenhouse effect that would lead to the extinction of the human species. That's what gets some people motivated. It's unclear that that's actually possible, but if it did happen, that would pretty much be game over before civilization, and there are other possibilities as listed. Now, the other possibility is, of course, that's kind of a gloomy way of looking at it. That's the, we're a bunch of suicidal goons with our finger on the button. But in fact, we don't need to be self-destructive to have a short-lived civilization. The simple fact is, nature is actually pretty cruel. We have many examples within the history of the Earth in which very successful species were pretty well exterminated by external factors over which they had absolutely no control. For example, the primary, of course, is an asteroid or meteor impact. A big cometary impact in the wrong place at the wrong time could potentially exterminate most land species on this planet. It's happened at least once for sure, and probably a couple of times in the distant past. The other possibility is that the danger actually comes from another star, but not from a civilization on that star, but from the star itself. A massive star detonating as a supernova, or an especially energetically directed variation of that called a gamma ray burst, carries sufficient energy that if it occurs within proximity to the Earth, could in fact bathe the Earth in enough ultraviolet radiation and X-rays to sterilize the surface and a few meters down through the surface of the ocean. These are extremely rare. It's thought to be unlikely. And in fact, there's some work that even we did here at Ohio State about the frequency of the most energetic of these. These are explosions that produce tight beams of gamma rays that are often the brightest thing in the universe for a few, tens of milliseconds to seconds. If you were directly down the throat of that gamma ray beam, it would literally sterilize the planet. Turn your hair orange and strip the paint right off your house. But they turn out to be extremely rare, and in fact, they seem to be even more rare as galaxies evolve and become more metal-rich, because metal-poor stars seem to be predominantly the source of the gamma-ray burst-type explosion. That's actually work at Ohio State that's begun to establish that particular fact. So maybe the presence of advancing metal abundance in the galaxy staves off sterilization due to gamma-ray bursts. But it's not out of the realm of these are phenomena that are observed. The question is whether you just get unlucky. You're in the wrong part of the galaxy at the wrong time. The other part is our planet is geologically active. There are possible geological catastrophes that can occur. For example, massive volcanism can occur on this Earth. The Deccan Flood, for example, is a massive volcanic flood that altered the Earth's atmosphere and biosphere very dramatically back in ancient geological times. For example, even just a short, small-scale activity, the Yellowstone Basin is, in fact, one of the largest seismically active calderas on the planet. If the unlikely possibility that the Yellowstone Basin caldera actually decided to erupt, it would be a supervolcano and probably at least sterilize the North American continent. Deep ice ages have occurred. At least twice we have had a snowball Earth incident. So it's entirely possible, even if it hasn't happened to us, it might happen to another civilization that they live in a period where the climate is unstable and subject to a snowball Earth type of environment. The conditions that we think led to a snowball Earth have to do with unusually large polar oceans, which we do not possess now, and the Earth's climate is, relatively speaking, stable against snowball Earth. The last one on Earth occurred just before the Cambrian explosion of life 600 million years ago. So they're not unknown. There's at least two, well-established incidences of these, one in the very ancient past and the other just before the beginning of the Phanerozoic. You can imagine an unlucky civilization that's just getting itself going when the planet switches into a deep planet-wide ice age and basically freezes them out. So these are the kinds of geological catastrophes based on the history of the Earth that it doesn't have to happen to us, but it could happen to any other being that arises on a geologically active planet. Remember when we talked about the characteristics that make the Earth habitable? Having a stable, regulated atmosphere was in large measure due to the fact that the Earth was geologically and tectonically active. If that turns out to be a common characteristic, then these become common risks for civilizations emerging on those worlds, even if on our own world we think we're in a relatively stable phase. Now, there's ample precedent for all of these things to have possibly occurred to us, so there's no reason to believe they could not occur to others. And in fact, it's exactly those facts, that these things could have occurred on Earth and could easily occur on others, that has led to probably the more extreme statement of the resolution of the Fermi paradox, the so-called rare Earth hypothesis. This one is basically what I call extreme Drake equation pessimism writ large. The idea poses that complex intelligent life on a habitable Earth is extremely rare. In fact, I put very rare because I wanted to leave two lines and I ran out of space. We're the product of an extremely unlikely combination of both geological and astronomical circumstances. Okay, How does this work? Well, the first idea is that we're in the right part of our galaxy. We're in the relatively metal-rich part of our galaxy, where really energetic supernovae are rare. So we don't get every few billion year massive supernova sterilization events. We're around exactly the right kind of star that has been burning in a kind of a low, slow, stable way for up to 10 billion years. Most of the stars are flare stars. They have these massive sterilizing flares on red dwarf stars. We're lucky enough not to be around one of those. They live for a long time, but their environments may be too hostile. We're on the right kind of planet. We happen to be on a planet that's just the right size, so its atmosphere is not too heavy, but not so small that its atmosphere is too light and lost. It's in exactly the habitable zone of our star, so water can be stable on there. That's a really narrow range. As you remember, we talked about the habitable zone. It was a very narrow range of our solar system where the Earth could live. So there's, three unlikely things in a row. The other thing, though, they start piling it on, the Earth has a large moon that stabilizes its rotation. Rotation on a fluid body, which is actually the interior of the Earth, is mostly fluid. If you try spinning a can full of soup, you notice that you can get it spinning for a while, but then internal friction, it suddenly goes into a rapid tumble. Rotation of fluid bodies turns out to be inherently unstable, unstable on long terms. And so the point is that they're making here is saying that we've got a very large moon, and that moon exerts very strong tides on the Earth, and that those tides have had a dynamically stabilizing influence on the rotation of the Earth. We've had an intermediate tilt, so we have relatively mild seasons. We haven't tilted over, so we're getting extreme seasons or no seasons at all. And that has been an aspect of helping. It's a contingent aspect that has helped Earth stabilize. The other thing that comes into play is that if you look at the history of life on Earth, very complex life has only arisen in the last half a billion years on this planet, beginning of the Cambrian explosion. Intelligence is relatively more recent. As I said before, if you take all the geological history of the Earth from formation to the present, and you place it in the context of 1 year, human intelligence arose a blink of an eye, a fraction of a second ago in that year. So we are literally an eye blink of geological history. That makes us exceedingly rare on our own planet as intelligences. So what the rare Earth hypothesis does is say, I've got so many unlikely things in a row that when I multiply each of those together, the answer for how many civilizations there should be in the galaxy in an instant is less than one, and that when you average across the lifetime of the galaxy, there should be between zero and one, and we just happen to be it because we're the ones here asking the question. So the conclusion of the rare Earth hypothesis is that not only are there intelligent species rare, but we're it for the galaxy, that it relies on such a concatenation of unlikely contingent effects that it hasn't arisen. I'm not 100% sure I agree with this. And part of the reason for that is I think that's an unnecessarily provincial point of view. And we've taken the point of view along with caveats that when we try to understand the nature of life on Earth, we're going to try to use Earth's history and our own experience as a guide because it's the only one we have. But we always keep in the back of our mind that that's a somewhat limiting assumption. This now takes that limiting assumption as given and runs it through to its end. Maybe I'm just uncomfortable with this, but the other things I'm uncomfortable with is there's too many just-so steps in the chain here that we realize are not strong objections. For example, the necessity of a moon stabilizing the rotation. There's actually no evidence that the other planets which do not possess large moons are similarly massively unstable. So even among the examples of our own solar system, unstable rotation is not the rule. In fact, stable rotation seems to be the rule pretty much everywhere. There are some hints of something else going on, but those are related to giant impacts, not to inherent instability. The idea of being in the right place in our galaxy around the right kind of star, again, those seem to be massive extrapolations of pretty thinly known facts. And so this part is really hard to countenance, that we're in exactly the right part of the galaxy. That's like Goldilocks squared. Not too likely. So there's a lot of reasons not to like the rare earth hypothesis, but it does sort of sit at one extreme between the heavily populated galaxy of science fiction and we're all alone, which seems a terrible thought. Now the question, of course, is, we haven't even addressed, as we've talked a lot about life in this class, what would intelligent life look like? What do we expect it to look like? Don't know, but we'll talk about that tomorrow.